holding on Lamed Omed Aleph, three lines, the last word of the third line from the bottom. We're in the middle of talking about the whole business about uncovered liquids, wine in particular,
right,
where a snake might drink from it and therefore it'd be dangerous.
Right.
We went through the various things, the various types of wine where there's not an issue. We said in the end the conclusion was that yain mevushel, there's no issue, snakes won't drink from it. On the other hand, diluted wine, they could, at least in some cases, and therefore to be on the safe side, we've got to be careful in all cases. Person is there, it's not going to prevent them from drinking it.
But if it's not there...
But if a person is there, even if a person is awake, then it'll prevent them from not be sleeping. The last thing we said was you have different kinds of wines that are either of lower or higher quality than normal, and they taste much different. They're sharp, they're bitter, they're sweet. Then snakes don't drink from them, and therefore they're safe. So now more on that. Omer of Shimon Lakish, Krina ein bei mishum gilui. There's no issue of gilui with Krina. My krina. So what is krina? Amar Rabbo, chamra chalya da'ofi me'afya. This is a sweet wine that comes from Afya. Afya is nowadays, well, it means specifically Asia Minor, Turkey, yeah. So there's a type of sweet wine that comes from there called krina. That's the second line from the bottom, man. So that's what it is. It's a sweet wine that comes from Afya, and they're from Asia Minor, and snakes aren't attracted to it. However, Omar Rava over Mukhaima Yeshba Mishum Gilui, however Rava says that's true if you import this wine someplace else in the world, then snakes won't drink from it. However, if it's right there in Asia Minor, wherever Afya is, in Turkey, wherever Afya is exactly, in that place itself, then snakes are apt to drink from it because as opposed to anywhere else. My time of Chamar Medina, because it's the local wine. In other words, given that snakes are attracted to wine, as we said before, so if their local wine happens to be the sweet stuff, the local snakes will have developed a taste for it, and therefore they'll drink it. So if you were to bring it elsewhere, then they wouldn't. But when all the wine in that area is of this type, it's a sweet wine. Then snakes, since they're going to want to drink something, then they'll end up drinking it. Yeah.
So that means to say, In France, for instance, they have only dry wine, most of it.
So I guess then in that case...
So then in case the snakes wouldn't be attracted?
So they might be attracted, because again, it's Chamar Medina. Again, like we said yesterday, you know, in principle, the dinim about snakes don't apply nowadays, because most places
the
world you don't have. But yeah, in principle, the reasoning would apply. Omar Rava, so Rava says further in this connection, last line, Hai chamra de achrim, when wine starts spoiling, so it started turning into vinegar, but it didn't quite get there yet. Ad tlosa yoimi yeshva mishum gilui, within the first 3 days, there is still an issue of gilui, because it's not completely turned to vinegar yet, and therefore snakes won't drink from it. Therefore snakes will drink from it, rather, so it's still dangerous. Umishum yain nefah, and the concept of yain nefah also applies to it, if a goy touches it, because they could conceivably use it for libations at that point. Mikan ve'elach, after 3 days have passed, ein be mishum gilui ve'ein be mishum yayin nesach, there's no issue of gilui, there's no issue of yayin nesach.
For 30 days.
Yeah, 3 days. 3 days. 3 days. Because after 3 days already, it's not wine anymore. It's become vinegary enough.
Open?
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether it's open. If it's closed, then snakes don't get into it anyway. Then if a goy touches it or stirs it or whatever, we'll learn. Again, later on in the Masechta, we're going to talk in greater detail what a goy needs to do for wine actually to after it. But for the moment, all we need to know is that wine within those first 3 days, when it's starting to spoil, can become yayin nesach. After that, Rava says it cannot.
Okay.
Yeah, in whatever way, it would become yayin nesach.
We're
talking about in the ways in which it would become yayin nesach, by a goy touching it or by a goy shaking it or whatever, yeah.
Touching,
we haven't gotten into the details yet. Again, the details about what exactly a goy has to do and what kind of goy and whatever, we're going to deal with later on in the Nuns and the Samas and the Ayin, the last 20 blot of Omasekta. Here we're dealing with it as a beginning of, in general, as part of the regular, as part of the general category of goyish of foods and drinks that are offered. Yeah. Okay. However, on the other hand, the Chachamim of Nahar Dar said, no, even after 3 days, we have to be concerned that if it's less uncovered. even though it's already turned to vinegar. My timer, why is that zimnin mikri shasi? Because sometimes it could happen that one particular snake comes by and drinks from it. And therefore, we got to be careful. So there's no three-day leeway. So apparently, then our Dori would agree that after that point, it's not Yayin Nesach. They just disagree on the snake issue, on the Gilui issue. With that said, we mentioned before that the Tosfos says that since nowadays we're not really sure at what point it becomes, at what point the transition from being wine to being vinegar, and you have times when it smells like vinegar and still tastes like wine and vice versa, we're not necessarily expert in that kind of thing. Therefore, what we say is that it remains osur until once you get to the point, as far as the Ainesak is concerned, that is, until you get to the point where the vinegar has gotten so strong that if you pour it on the ground, it bubbles, then for sure it's not wine anymore. Then there's no question about it. Again, all this is talking about, obviously, if it was still in the hands of the Jew all that time, and only after that a goy touches it or whatever. If you have wine of a goy that turned into vinegar, then as we said in the Mishnah, it still retains its business. That's why nowadays, when you buy wine
from a Jew that falls into the hands of a goy,
if it's already turned to vinegar, then it's okay. If it already turned to vinegar, it already reached that level of vinegariness before the goy touched it, then you're fine. But this is why. I mean, when you buy wine vinegar in the store, I mean, you have to make sure nowadays just make sure everything has a hechsher anyway because they put in so many different ingredients. But whatever, even before that, you would need a hechsher because you'd have to make sure that was made from kosher wine. Yeah. All right. Turn it up on them. More details on the dinim of gilui. Yayin toseis ein b'mishum gilui. Wine that is fermenting, there's no issue of gilui. Fermenting, in other words, that it's turning, so it was
vinegar?
No, turning into wine. It's turning from grape juice into wine. Yayin, in a more general sense, can mean grape juice as well. But kamas tisa, so gimel yomim. How long is that period of tisa called, the tosis? It's 3 days.
The initial fermentation period.
But pashtos, I mean, the Gemara is going to say soon, for example, that if you have a liquid that's constantly dripping, then snakes are going to be scared away from it by the noise of the drip, by the dripping, or the fact that it disturbs the surface or whatever. Well, the same thing. When wine is first fermenting, you have carbon dioxide is forming and whatever. So probably also would keep the snakes away. Yeah. So during those 3 days. Yeah. No, it's not so much smart, but they can sense danger. They sense danger in general. Like most wild animals, they're not attracted to things where things are moving around or whatever. They want things to be quiet about them because you never know what predators. Yeah, okay. They have the necessary amount of brains that Hashem gave them.
Not too much.
Okay. Onward. Hashachalayim ein behem mishum gilui. What about shachlayim? Shachlayim is crest. We've talked about it here and there in the last few couple of days. That's the Hebrew name for it. What they used to do in those days, we're not talking about raw crest, which is just a vegetable. There's no more concern with that as far as snakes than anything else. But typically what they would do...
Bugs in these crests.
Yeah, that's true, but that's neither here nor there. That's a different issue. But what they used to do with crest in those days, very commonly, they would grind it up and mix it with wine or with water and drink it and drink it as a health drink. Crest with wine or water, I don't know. Crest has a certain peppery taste.
Very, very bitter.
It's not bitter per se. It's more peppery, sharp, or whatever. Yeah. So they would make a drink like that. So shachlayim ein behem mishum gilui. There's no issue of gilui with them because there's no issue of gilui with them. Snakes aren't attracted to them. However, b'nei goyla nagu behem isser. However, the people of the goyla, which means bavel, were noyig and isser in it. Because they figured that sometimes snakes do drink from them. V'lei amoren el adalas b'huchala. Now that only applies though if there's no vinegar in it. Avol is b'hu chala migri b'hu. But if there is vinegar in it, then it fights against them. So Rashi explains that what it means is, in other words, so again, this shachlayim, this quest mixture, you could mix it with water, you could mix it with wine, you could also, in some places, they mix it with vinegar, and they would use it as a dip or whatever. So the point is, therefore, if it's made with water or wine, then we're saying that, in principle, there's no problem of gilui with it. However, in Bavel, they were careful. But if it's made with vinegar, then we're saying that just the opposite. It'll repel the snake for the same reason as we said before. The snakes aren't attracted to vinegar. It burns their mouth. The acid, they don't like it. Therefore, it's okay. Then even in other words, even in Bavel, they wouldn't have a problem with that. Actually, Tosfos and also the Rid learn differently, that migri bahu can also mean it whets their appetite. So just the opposite. If the shachlayim are mixed with vinegar, then even outside of Babel, you need to be careful about it because it may attract the snake. Apparently, they wouldn't drink pure vinegar, but they might drink shachlayim that's mixed with vinegar.
Even according to Russian, don't they have to taste it once to know?
No, they would smell it. And most animals have a much sharper sense of smell than we do, and the smell itself is enough to give them an idea whether it's something worth drinking.
10 miles away they can smell.
Okay.
I
don't know, 10 miles away, but okay, fine. All right. Onward. Another one. Kuta Chababli Ein Be Mishum Gilui. Another kind of food that the dinim of Gilui don't apply to is Kuta Chababli, which is also... We've talked about Kuta Chababli before, yeah. It's made out of whey, out of milk and boiled bread crumbs. So it's sort of like sour cream. It's a little bit like sour cream or maybe a little bit like feta cheese or whatever. That was the name of it. That was the name of the dip. Babli, because they used to use it a lot in Babel. They would use it as a dip for their bread. So it was sort of like sour cream, but maybe sharper than that.
From a cow.
They use whey of milk. They use whey of milk. They use spoiled. They put in spoiled bread crumbs, whatever. And also, Gemara mentions in Pesach, and we were talking about this in connection with Halacha of the Pesach. The Gemara mentions over there that it also contains salt. Those were the three ingredients of it. Anyway,
Elo
Ovrin is the name of a perek in
the. I know, but what Ovrin in terms of. Against the halacha,
there's different explanations in the Mefarshim on that. Either it means Elo Ovrin, that you're over on the dinim of Pesach by having these, if you have these in a house on Pesach, or Elo Ovrin, these have to be removed from the world before Pesach. But actually, a toast was discussed over there, yeah. Anyway, the point is,
cheese, basically.
It's sort of like cottage cheese, sort of like sour cream, maybe, I don't know, whatever it was. The Gemara talked about over there, it's not very healthy for you. In Shabbos, the Gemara talked about that in Eretz Yisrael, if you'd even mentioned Kuta Chababli for them, they'd be nauseous because they couldn't bear the thought of such a food, but whatever. Okay, different places, different weird foods. Yeah. The Gemara mentions, on the other hand, they had a type of chicken soup in Eretz Yisrael that the Babylon were repelled by. So yeah, you know. Anyway,
the Babylonians were
not regular chicken soup. This was a kind where they cook the chicken for so long that it would dissolve into the soup. So a babli would hear of that, it would make him nauseous. And on the other hand, if the Bnei Eretz Yisrael would hear about Kuta Chababli, someone mentioned Kuta Chababli for them, okay. They'd feel nauseous. And then, yeah, okay. Anyway, so Kuta Chababli ain't where Mishum Gilui. So Kuta Chababli, there's also no issue of Gilui, because again, it's sharp like vinegar, and therefore snakes won't drink from it. But again, Bnei Goyla Nogubo Yisrael, but again, the Bnei Goyla were knowing an Yisrael on it. Sometimes in the Gemara, actually, Goyla doesn't always mean the entire country of Babel. Sometimes it just means specifically the city of Nahar Dar or Kompadissa. In some places, it seems from the Gemara that Bnei Goyla specifically means the family of Reb Chiya. So here it might mean any of the above. Anyway, so some people were knowing and doing it. Occasionally, snakes might drink from it after all. Okay.
What is it made out of?
Kutach HaBavli, we just said it's made out of whey of milk, the liquid that's left over after you make cheese, spoiled bread, and milk. However, Rav Menashe says, if you see in the Kuta Chababli that there's evidence of it having been pecked at or bitten out of or whatever, Nikuri is like you see in it, like it's been pecked at by creatures or whatever, you see like there's holes or whatever, yeah, in it. Then Chashin, and then you have to be concerned that maybe the creature that drank from it was ate from it. Water or any kind of liquid with dripping drop after drop, ain't mishum gilu. There's no issue of gilu with it because again, the snake would be scared away by that. Tif tif means exactly that. It means water or any liquid that's dripping. Tif means drops. So Rashi gives an example. No, or any kind of liquid. Let's say for example. So Rashi gives an example. Let's say for example, you have a barrel of wine. And you have, let's say, a crack in it or something. So you put a container underneath it to catch the dripping wine. That bottom container, there's no problem of gilui because wine is dripping into it.
Meaning left open.
Well, any time, right, whenever we're concerned that snakes might get in it.
when we're doing the day.
So during the day in principle also. I mean, we said as long as there's nobody around it. In Trumas, the Mishnah talks about the dinim over there first in connection with Truma. It mentions over there that the amount of time that is about a slept uncovered, you have a problem, is long enough that a snake could conceivably have been nesting under the handle of a keli and crawl over there and drink and return to its nest, return to its hole.
I thought they're scared of
them. What?
Even during the day.
Even during the day, perhaps.
I thought a snake is scared of dripping, huh?
That's the point. Therefore, it's dripping, you don't have a problem. The snake is not going to try to get there. However,
because
then you have noise over there, you have movement or whatever, and it's a little snake way, and it thinks, you know, there may be predators over there, yeah. However, Ravashi says this is only if the dripping is constant, one drop after another, not just if you have one drop and then 5 minutes later another.
Then he wouldn't be
afraid. Then the snake wouldn't be afraid that way. Okay. Another din. Amar Rav Chiya Ba'ashi Yom HaShmuel, Pi Te'ena Ein Bei Mishum Gilui. The mouth of a fig, the opening of a fig, there's no issue of gilui. So the opening of a fig, Rashi explains, when you pull a fig off the tree, then you have there's a little opening over there where the stem was attached to the fruit. In principle you would think that maybe a snake could conceivably go and try to suck out the juice from it and inject venom into the fig. No, there's no problem with that. There's no problem with eating a fig that was left uncovered. Tosfos points out, by the way, on the basis of Gemara and Cholin, there's a couple of places in Cholin where it also discusses the dinim of gilui. That if, again, like we said before, in the case of the kutta, if you see evidence that there was pecking or that something bit from it, then you have to be concerned that that thing might have been a snake. But like this, when you have a normal fig where there's no particular evidence on it of anything having tried to bite into it, then you don't have to worry about it. Kaman ki hai tana, so who would that be like? That would be like the following tana. A person is allowed to eat grapes or figs at night without having to be concerned that a snake might have eaten from them and there's venom in them. There's no problem, even though you can't see clearly at night whether there's anything the matter with them. Because as the pasuk says, Hashem guards the innocent. Meaning you are responsible for your health.
Hashem guards the innocent, why do parts just the thing?
So that's a couple of the parts talk about it. So the idea is, in other words, there's a balance to be struck. You have a certain thing. You have to be careful with things that involve health. You can't just do whatever you want and say Hashem will protect me. But on the other hand, you have things where the possible danger is so remote. That's how the Meiri learns, for example, that the possible danger with figs is so remote that a snake should doubt to come and try to eat from this fig and inject venom, that already you don't have to worry about for that level.
It's sweet food,
fine, but they're usually going to drink from liquids. They're not going to usually go, they're going to drink from liquids, they're going to eat, as the Gemara will say, through foods that have a high water content, like watermelons or whatever. They're not necessarily going to go for a fruit that's juicy, but not liquid.
Why just
figs? So I don't know why we're mentioning particularly figs. I mean, dates, mistama would be
sweet.
Yeah, mistama would be the same thing. Maybe even more so, actually, because dates are harder. No, dates are harder than figs, though, so I don't know.
Right.
By the way, I mean, this pizza, you know, you have some of them approach and explain that what it is it means that when you have, sometimes when a fig is left on the tree and over-ripened, then the other end of it splits open. So again, the same thing. You would think that maybe a snake would take advantage. So we're saying that's the shame of Soyim Hashem. So again, one idea of it is the Meiri talks about, because as it is, it's so rare that a snake should try to go for figs that already at that point you don't have to be paranoid about it. Just at that point, leave things in Hashem's hands. Different explanation the Torah Chaim says is, the vote is, you're expected to take precautions about things that you're able to take precautions about. Water, for example, you keep in containers, keep the container covered and have done with it. Figs, they didn't usually keep in containers, they usually left figs out and about. So what are you supposed to do? You're never going to be allowed to eat figs at night? No, on that, you're Shem of Tzolim Hashem. On that, yeah, so that's what we're saying. On that Shem of Tzolim Hashem, you can rely on Hashem for that. And that kind of thing, by the way, comes a lot into discussions of different things. I mean, we know there are different things that are different behaviors that are and aren't healthy and that are and aren't unhealthy. Where do we draw the line exactly between what we need to guard our own health versus where we say Shem Tzayin Hashem? There's a lot of discussion about that. You can find discussions about it, for example, in connection with smoking, where it didn't used to be known the dangers of it, and therefore you could argue Shem Tzayim Hashem. Nowadays, it's more better known, and therefore that excuse kind of falls away. Different things like that. Okay. Omer of Safra Mishum Rabbi Yeshua Duroima. Rabbi Safra says in the name of Rabbi Yeshua Duroima. Duroima means the south, so the pashtus of Rabbi Yeshua was from the south of Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, Shloisha Mine Erepain. There are three kinds of snake venom. Shalbachor Shekea, venom from a young snake sinks to the bottom of the container. Shalbainanim Fapea, venom from a middle-aged snake hangs there in the middle of the liquid. It doesn't sink to the bottom, it doesn't float to the top. The Shalzokin stop. Venom from an old snake floats to the top.
To
the top of the container, the container of water or whatever. So the question, now, the assumption is, the pashtus, the idea is right. The younger snake's venom is much denser, and then as it gets older, it gets less and less dense, and therefore it floats. So the question is, remember, to come to koshish, kokish, chayle, are you telling me then that the older a snake gets, the weaker it gets? But we learned a b'raisa. No, shloisha kol zman shema skinin gvura mekasefet. And there are three creatures that the older they get, the stronger they get. Elohim, dog, nachash, v'chazir, a fish, a snake, and a chazir. So you see that a snake gets stronger as it gets older, not weaker. So what are you talking about? That its venom floats to the top. The answer is koyach oisufuhu dekomoisi. Sure, the muscular strength of the snake increases as it gets older. It gets bigger, so its muscles get stronger. Zira kolish, but its venom becomes weaker as it gets older. Kolish, man, it gets weaker as it gets older. Kolish, yeah. Kolish. Kolish is the Aramaic word for like fades away or whatever. It fades away, it becomes less powerful, less concentrated or whatever. So therefore it'll float to the top. So yeah, the snake itself and its muscles will be stronger, but its venom will be weaker. So we have to ask, why is it important for us to know this point that a younger snake's venom sinks to the bottom? So what?
You don't see it.
No, the question is, the answer is exactly, Tanya. Namely, as we learn in a Braisa, Chavis Shinis Gala, if you have a barrel of liquid that was left uncovered, even if 9 people drank from it and none of them died, nevertheless, even a 10th person should not drink from it because, yes, the snake, the venom in it, if there's venom in it, might be from a young snake, it might have sunk to the bottom, and that 10th person is going to get the dose of it and it'll kill him. In fact, the taka once happened. 9 people drank from a barrel and they didn't die. The shot that serious mess, and then the 10th one drank from it and he died because there was venom from a young snake in there.
Shouldn't you have a chazaka that there? That's good.
Yeah, chazakas don't, as we said in the Gemara yesterday, you don't use terutim when it comes to sakana. You remind me, though, actually, of an interesting point, which is Taz and the Shach discussed the point: can things that are dangerous be bottle b'shishim? The Taz argues maybe yes. The Shach argues, the Taz argues maybe yes. The Shach says, I can agree maybe with other kinds of things, not with snake venom, as we're saying over here, but with other kinds of things of danger. Yes, maybe, for example, fish and meat, let's say together, where the Gemara elsewhere tells us it's bad for your health. Fine, you can argue those are bottle shish, maybe. But the Shach says specifically, we see from this Gemara and from other Gemaras that it doesn't work with snake venom. Any amount in it is enough to throw away the whole
thing. Barrel
and
still be hit.
That's the point.
It's
right.
The
That's the point, right. And Omer Rabbi Yirmiyah is Zeru Shekeya. And so Rabbi Yirmiyah said, what happened in that case? The venom had sunk to the bottom. And that's why only the 10th guy got it. Which, by the way, Rashi points out. So he died, obviously. Yeah. That's what we said. We said it. Stop that through your mess. Yeah. Which, by the way, Rashi points out. Therefore, so now we understand why it's important to talk about all three types of snakes. Because therefore, by the same logic, you also can't say, well, if the first, you also can't say, well, I can be the first person to drink and it's okay because the venom won't be at the bottom. Because what if it was an old snake and the venom is at the top? You can't say I'll be the fourth or fifth person to drink. What if it was a middle-aged snake and the venom is at the top?
Can you see it?
So there's in some places there's a Mishnah I think someplace maybe also in Trumas that talks about that maybe in principle you could filter it out. Maybe like it hangs in place over there and therefore you could filter it out. According to one Tana. The Chachamim disagree with him, though, because it's not necessarily is it going to hang together like that.
It dissolves,
yeah. Okay. So by the same token, if you have a melon, a watermelon or whatever, that was left uncovered, and a melon is a melon is mostly water. So therefore, also, it is.
It is.
If we're talking about a watermelon over here, they're like over 90% water. If we're talking about other kinds of melons, fine. Maybe not. By weight, by volume, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, look it up. I think so, yeah. So by the same law,
you're eating
the flesh of it. So you have a little flesh and a lot of water in it. I don't know. Anyway, the point is that therefore, again, because it's very watery, because it's very liquidy, therefore, again, snakes will be attracted to it. And because, well, it's sweet, but also the point is because it's liquidy, therefore, because it's full of water, therefore, again, the venom can penetrate into it and be further on in the inside. So not necessarily is it going to remain in the outside layers. So the same thing. I'm a Tiachinus galsa. If you left a watermelon uncovered.
Watermelon?
Yeah, exactly. Chinus galsa that was left uncovered, yeah, after it was cut. So even if 9 people ate from it and didn't die, a 10th person should not eat from it because the venom may have sunk into the middle of it. And yeah, sure enough, you once had such a thing where 9 people ate from such a watermelon and they survived and then the 10th one was killed. And again, Rebbe said in this connection, yeah, so Rebbe Yirmiyah says on the side, again, there you have it, this must have been that it was bitten by a young snake where the venom is concentrated and sinks into the middle of it, and that's why only the 10th one got it.
What about the habits of Jeremiah? How is the eris of the snake getting into it? Doesn't he have to bite something in order for the venom to come out?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yeah, he ate some of the watermelon. Same thing. The snake drank some of the water. That's the whole point that we've been discussing, is that the fact that the snake will be attracted to the liquid and drink some of it and then inject venom as he's drinking. Same thing by drinking also, yeah. Turn it up on him. Okay, so now we have the question. Fine. So we've established, so now we've had this entire Gemara telling us that we're not allowed to drink such liquids that were left uncovered because a snake might have drunk from it. What about, okay, so you have to dispose of it. How should you dispose of it safely? You have toxic waste over here. How do you dispose of it safely?
What? You what?
Turn it up on him. Mayim shenis yalu, if you have water that was left uncovered, how is a loyish b'chem b'rishosad abim, you should not pour them out in rishosad abim, because what if a person walks by barefoot? And then they're going to have, they're walking barefoot, you have the cracks over there, the crevices between their toes, where therefore the enough of the venom can get in there and then find a way in through the skin. There won't necessarily be a break in the skin there per se, but once you have a pool of it in some crevice of the skin, then eventually it can get in. Yeah. So you shouldn't do that. You should not sprinkle them in the house to lay down the dust. Same problem, because you might walk around the house barefoot. You should not use them mixed with clay, because of the same problem that you may have that some of it will end up between your fingers or whatever as you're mixing the clay. Don't give them to drink to your own animal or to somebody else's animal.
Tells you what not to do, but what do you do?
So what do? You pour it away someplace where it won't be dangerous. And do not use, and a person should not use them to wash his face, hands, or feet. Okay. Fine. So the implication is you do something else with it. You find something else. You pour it away someplace where it won't harm anybody. You pour it into a garbage heap, for example, or you pour it into a place where people aren't likely to be going around barefoot or touch it with their bare hands or whatever. Acherim, which is usually the mayor says, Malkum Shiesh Sirta. It depends. You have to make sure it doesn't get anywhere on your skin. Anywhere where there's a crevice in the skin, where therefore this stuff could pool over there and eventually get in, then it's also ein sirta mutter. If there's no crevice over there, then it's mutter. So the question is, on the face of it, isn't Acherim saying the same thing as the Tanakama? Because you have crevices in various places in your face and hands and feet, for example, between your fingers, between your toes, you have the nose, the lips or whatever. So if the Tanakama is saying don't wash your face, hands, and feet with it, and Acherim is saying don't have it anywhere where there's a crevice in the body, then what's the difference? Yeah. The answer is, Ikeminayu, Gavayad, Gavaregel, Rumli Da'ah. Yes, but the nafkamina between them would be, what about, can you use them to wash the backs of your hand, or the back of your hand, or the top of your foot, or the rumni of the, or the rumni of the face? Rumni, there's two possibilities what rumni means. It can either mean the cheek. Rashi just says, Rashi uses the French word pomilla, which means like the apples of the face, which are near the eyes. So either Rashi means the cheeks or he means the temples.
No, the cheeks.
It could be the cheeks. It could be the temples.
Temples. Why would he?
Because they also have a certain resemblance. So they in a healthy person they look like reddish or whatever. So anyway, the point is, according to the Tanakhama, doesn't matter. It's true there's no crevices in the skin there, but we're saying don't use them to wash your face or hands or feet, period. Any part of your face, any part of your hands, any part of your feet. Whereas Acherim are saying only...
Because it can penetrate into your eyes.
So therefore, Acherim are saying... So Acherim are saying, look, your cheeks or your temples, there's no crevices over there. As long as you're careful to keep it away from your eyes and nose and mouth, then the same thing with the back of your hand, the same thing with the top of your with the top side of your foot. Then Acherim are saying there shouldn't be a problem using this kind of water to wash those areas. Okay, Amamar, we said in the Braitha, we said you shouldn't give them to drink to your own animal or to your friend's animal. So the question is, we learn in another braisa, you are allowed to give such water to drink to your own animal. So what is it? You have a contradiction. The answer is, kitanyahi l'shunra. Yes, but that second braisa is specifically talking about a cat. A cat is not affected by the venom of snakes. In fact, Rashi brings from a Gemara in Stochim that cats eat snakes. So they're not affected by the venom. So therefore,
snakes.
I've never seen a cat eating a snake, but yeah. Okay, so I guess they do.
I've seen a cat being eaten by a snake.
Depends on what kind of snake, I guess.
Okay. Which is,
fine, you're talking about like pythons or whatever. Okay, we're not talking about those kinds of snakes. We're talking about venomous snakes. Pythons aren't venomous. They just they're constrictors or whatever. We're talking about venomous snakes over here. So cats will eat venomous snakes, and they're not affected by the venom, so therefore, you're allowed to give such water to a cat to drink.
They don't eat the head.
Whatever, no, apparently they eat the whole thing. Okay, the question is, Ihochi dechavre nami. Well, in that case, why should you only be allowed to give such water to your own cat and not somebody else's? Why can't you give it to your neighbor's cat? Right? The answer is dechavre kokish. Yes, true, it won't kill the cat, but it will weaken it, and therefore you can't do that. So the question is, dige nami kokish? Because it's somebody else's animal. Because it's somebody else's animal. So the question is, Dide Nami Kochish, but your own animal also becomes weaker. Okay, so maybe it is Sab Al Chaim. The answer is, or not Sab Al Chaim, maybe Baal Pashfit. You're damaging a creature for no particular reason. You want to get rid of the water, fine, but it's not necessarily a valid enough reason. You could always find some place to pour it. Where
it's very, very easy to grab.
Yeah, I suppose so. The answer is Hodur Bori. The answer is, okay, a cat will feel sick for a while after drinking venom, but afterwards it'll recover. Okay, so the question is back to the chavre nami hodur bori. Fine, so and if you give it to somebody else's cat also, it'll be sick for a while and then it'll recover. What's the problem? The answer is zimni de bori lezabuna, because what happens if the other guy wants to sell his cat during that time when it's feeling the effects of it, or maskid levine, and then you're causing him a loss. So you yourself, you give it to your cat, it's sick, let's say, for the next 3 days or whatever. Okay, so you wait 3 days and then you sell it. You can't impose that on the other person, that he should have to wait those few days to sell his cat. So therefore, don't do it. No, that's the point. You have this dangerous water you need to get rid of that might have venom in it. You're giving it. You're thinking you'll give it to your neighbor's cat, but the problem is that what you're doing, you're making the cat who's going to be sick for a while.
I understand. Another word, the case is you need to get rid of the water.
Right.
And either give it to his own cat or another.
So therefore, don't give it to somebody else's cat. Give it to your own cat if you want. The Ram has a different understanding of this Gemara, by the way. The Ram says it's not necessarily specifically cats. What it means is you can give it to any animal. In principle, you could give it to any animal which you're not going to end up eating. Cats are not kosher animals. But by the same logic, apparently, the Ram is saying you could just as well give it to a dog or a horse or what have you. Same issue, though. It'll be sick for a while, but then it'll recover. However, though, the point is, in that case, so why are we mentioning specifically cats and things like that? Because the point is, because the point is, you might have thought, let's say, for example, with a kosher animal, there won't be an issue about tashchis because you'll give it to the animal to drink, and right away you'll chef the animal. But the problem is that then you have venom in the animal, which you might end up eating. So therefore, that's the point of the Gemara, according to the Rana. Don't give it to a kosher animal at all, because if it's long term, then because if you're not going to shecht it right away, then you have a matter of bal tashchis. And if you are, then you yourself are going to be endangered by the venom. On the other hand, you can give it to a treif animal, such as a cat, but meaning any other kind, because you're not going to be eating it anyway. The only problem is, don't do it to somebody else, is because you're going to temporarily be weak. Okay.
You
what? Say what?
You allowed to kill the cat in case you give it to him?
No, why would you? No, because we just said the venom won't affect us, won't kill the cat. It'll weaken it. It'll make it sick for a while, but won't kill it. Okay. Now we're going to get back to Yain Nesser.
It would be a good test to try with a sofa.
Yeah, but that's not.
See, I don't understand. You're saying that if the cat, if the snake drinks of the water, it's going to inject venom.
Yeah.
But I suspect that not every time they eat or drink something, they give venom.
No, of course not. But you have
to live with nothing. You have to keep it for,
That's fine. But nevertheless, you're still taking the risk. We just said before, a person drank, 10 people drank from a barrel of wine, 10 people ate from a watermelon. So, yeah, so you have to be careful just on the safe side in case the snake might have injected venom, right? All right, so now we're going to get back to Yain Nesser. And now we're done for now with the digression about jewelry. So again, nowadays in principle these halachas of jewelry don't apply because nowadays for the most part we don't live in places where there are such kinds of venomous snakes. However, by the way, the Gemara
goes by
not so much minhag ha'makom, but it goes by what those local conditions are. Besides which, also actually later on the Gemara is going to point out, in fact, that there's a difference in this regard between Jews and goyim, that goyim are not as affected by this kind of thing, which is why when we talked about yesterday that goyim are not always careful about jewelry, and I was saying then because they don't know the halachas and because they wouldn't necessarily see the cause and effect between a person drinks and dies, because people died from all kinds of things based on the Gemara later. There's a difference. There's a better answer is they're not as affected by it. So it's another example. In other words, the point is it's an example. It's another one of these examples of Mishtanu Akivin. It could be another one of these examples. The Gemara over here doesn't mention that. Maybe you could. I don't know. But the Gemara just mentioned what you can't do with it. It didn't say what you can. But could be. But whatever it is, it could be another one of these things, Mishtanu Akivim, that even Jews nowadays, therefore, have a different body chemistry than before, and therefore are not as affected by this kind of thing. I don't know. Whatever it is, again, like we said before, technically the halacha is that these halachas don't apply nowadays. However, there is an idea from the Shalach HaKadosh and from the Vilna Gaon, just still be careful about them.
They joke and they say, this sounds like a goy. Presumably a goy is not affected by certain things. Maybe,
right.
Maybe, in other words, it's a McGregor to be affected by things.
Could be, yeah. Okay.
I know a guy wants to eat. He wants to eat that kind of culture. And every time I eat in a non-culture place, my stomach turns. I was looking for a culture place to eat.
Okay.
That is all right.
You eat in a non-culture?
No. He's talking about a guy.
He can't stand
non-culture.
Okay. Give him part of the vegan. What's wrong with that? All right. Onward. Amr of Asi, Amr of Yechen, and Shum of Yehuda ben Bethel. There are three types of wine that have different genes. Three types of wine where there are goyim involved, where there are different jews. Coming back to Yain Nesser now. For the moment now, we're done with the matter of jewelry. The Gemara takes it up again briefly later on Laman Aleph Omer Beis, but for now, we're back to Yain Nesser. So there's three kinds of wine as far as the dinim of Yain Nesser, or Stam Yainim, whatever. Yain Nesser also b'hana, actual wine that was actually poured out in honor of an idol, is also b'hana, like anything that was offered Java Dezara. And it has a stringent level of tumma when there's a kezias of it. Now, normally, when it comes to liquid, usually the amount is a revi.
Right.
Here we're saying kezias, which is a smaller amount, because, as we said before, we said at the beginning of the sugya after the Mishnah, that we learn by a hekesh that yain netzach and also bana from zebach, from carbonus that are brought to geshkes. Carbonus are solids, like meat or bread or what have you, and therefore the amount for them is kezias. Therefore, for yain netzach, the amount for tumah is also kezias. The whole concept of tumah, of Avodah Zarah and things associated with Avodah Zarah is Dirabbanan. The Rambam points out, based on various Gemaras, that you have a remez for it in the Pasuk. You find that when Yaakov is taking his family to Beis El to fulfill his neder over there, he says to everybody over there, get rid of all of the Avodah Zarah items that you have with you, v'hi taharu, and make yourselves tar, implying that as long as they have Avodah Zarah things around, they're tameh. However, even though it's mentioned in the Torah, it's not, even though you have that remez in the Torah, it's not an actual din d'oraisa, it's only a din d'rabbanan. That Avodah Zarah is metameh. That Avodah Zarah is metameh. It's the Rabbanon. Avodah Zarah itself or anything that was used in connection with Avodah Zarah. There's three kinds of things, actually. Later on in the Masechta, we're going to deal with in the next parak. You have Avodah Zarah itself. You have Meshamshei Avodah Zarah, things that are used to serve the Avodah Zarah for, you know, pots and pans, things like that or whatever. And then clothing, for example, would be another example. Clothing that the idol was dressed in or whatever. And then you have Tikrovis Avodah Zarah, things that are offered as sacrifices there. Bread, wine, whatever. Yeah. All of them are tumah d'rabbanan. And there was a machloikas, there's a machloikas tanoim. What level of tumah do they have? Do they have the level of tumah of a mess, which in that case would mean that they're metameh, the maga b'masa of oil, by touching them, by carrying them, or by being under the same roof with them? Or are they metameh, that's what Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira says. So that's what he means by tumah chamura, means the stringent level of tumah. As opposed to the Chachamim hold, which we'll get to later, that the Chachamim hold, it only has a lesser level of tumah. It only has a tumah like the tumah of a sheva, if you touch it or if you carry it. Never mind mashkin. That's we're going to get to in a minute. But right now we're talking about yayin netzach, where it was actually poured in honor of Avodah Zarah. So it's the krovis of Avodah Zarah. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira holds that the Avodah Zarah itself, as well as the meshamshim, as well as the krovis, are all metame like a mess. Therefore, they're metame ba'oihol as well. You find there's a Mishnah in Shabbos where Rabbi Akiva says the same thing and brings a hint from a pasuk for it. The Chachamim disagree with that, though. They say that no, they say it's only metameh. Actually, no, I should say, sorry, Rabbi Akiva says something different. Rabbi Akiva over there in Shabbos says differently, that it's metameh like a nidah. The Chachamim hold it's metameh like a sheret, which is in a way it's not. Among the Ovis HaTruma, among the various Ovis HaTruma, a sheret is one of the least is one of the least serious kinds of Ovis HaTruma. You touch a sheret. First of all, you're only metame if you touch it, or you're only metame if you touch it, or if you carry it. Not by oil. What?
A dead sheret.
Yeah, we're talking about dead sheret. Yeah. I don't even remember if a sheret is metame b'masa. It's metame b'maga. It's definitely not metame b'oil. I don't remember if a sheret is metame b'masa. Whatever it is, so the halacha is it's only metame like a sheret. I think that's what it is. A sheret is only metame b'maga. A nida would also be metame b'masa. If you touch it directly, right? If you use an instrument, if I remember correctly, you're not tumed by a sheret.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that, but I think so.
Because otherwise it would be
a nida is metame b'maga or b'masa, and a mess is metame b'oil as well. You have a three-way machlokes on it. So anyway, the halacha is that it's metame for the most part like a sheret. Actually, the Rambam goes on to say over there, based on various Gemaras, there are certain kulas in it like a sheret, and certain kulas in it like a nida. Yeah, we're talking about the Avodah Zarah itself, we're talking about Meshamshim. Yeah, so actually what it is, actually I remember what it is now. What it is like this.
So you have to ask the question whether
a Selim is something they actually worship or whether it's just something they use as a symbol of their religion.
Worship it.
I don't know. I mean, it's not like they necessarily bring carbonus to it or whatever.
They bow.
Okay, I don't know if they're bowing to what it represents. I don't know that makes it considered. I don't know. In Shulchan Aruch, it talks about there's a difference between a selim itself, the kind that's hanging in a church, versus the kind they wear around their necks or whatever. I don't know. Okay, the kind in a church, maybe it would be in the time. I don't know. Anyway, that's what it is actually like this. So again, the halacha is kind of like a sheret. However, actually, what it is the Rambam talks about that. Now, on the other hand, you have, let's say, for example, a sheret. If you touch the entire dead sheret, you become tameh. If you touch a piece of it, a kadosha, a lentil-sized piece of it, you also become tameh. On the other hand, a nida, not. If you touch a nida while she's alive and her body is intact, you become tameh, or if you carry her. But if you have, let's say, for example, a piece of skin or whatever that came off her, then it wouldn't be metameh if you touch it. By the same logic, with Avodah Zarah, we're makel to that extent, that it's like a nida in the sense that if you touch a broken piece off of Avodah Zarah, you don't become tameh.
And a broken piece of a
sheretz? A broken piece of a sheretz you would, as long as it's the size of kadasha. So that's the point. We're making, Avodah Zarah has the coolest of sheretz that it's not matame b'masa, and the coolest of nida that if it's broken in pieces, it's not matame.
Sometimes you see a broken piece of Avodah Zarah that you assume that it was broken.
That's a different matter. We'll deal with that in the next paragraph. Yeah, but sometimes if you find broken pieces, yeah, that's true. But that's a different matter. We're talking about when you know it was possible. But okay, anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, though, is saying that Yayin Nesek, where it was actually poured out in honor of Avodah Zarah, is Metame Tumah Chamura. It has the strictest level of Tumah, meaning like a mess. So it's Metame B'maga and B'masa and B'oil. Because again, we have the Hekesh at the beginning of our Sovia. We have the Hekesh, or right after the Mishnah, rather. We have the Hekesh between Zivchei Mesim and Mes.
Well, what did we say over there?
We said over there about Yochlu Zivchei Mesim, and a Mes itself is also Bana. So therefore, there's reason to compare Avodah Zarah to a Mes. Yeah. Okay, that's category number one. Says Ra'afi in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Category two, Stam Yenam Asabana, Stam Yenam, where it was touched by or handled by Goyim, but we don't know whether they did mix up with it. So that kind is Asabana. It's Asabana because of the Gzeira of the Chachamim. However, Umatama, Tumas Mashkin, but it's not, it doesn't become Tomei to the same degree as the Tuma Chamura that we said before. Instead, it can only become, it only has the Dinim of Tuma at Tumas Mashkin, which is a lesser level of Tumah, like a sheretz, in other words, where
any
Goyish wine, right? The point would be in other words, what happens with Tumas Mashkin is, in other words, that it can make other foods and drinks Tumah, but it can't make people Tumah and it can't make Kalim Tumah. And the amount would be Berevius, not a Kedayim. We have two colors in it for in Stam Yenam over Yain Nefesh so far. Number one, the degree of Tumah is less. It's only Tumas Mashkin rather than Tumas Mes, and the quantity is more the Revius rather than a Kedayim. Tosfos argues with Rashi on the meaning of Tumas Mashkin. Tosfos says what it means is we're not talking about whether it's able to become Tumah. You don't need a Revius. When you have a certain amount of liquid, you don't need a Revius of it to become Tumah. Any amount of liquid can become Tumah. We're talking about Rashi agrees with that point. I mean, there is such a point in various places in the Gemara where we see. Okay, so 1 second. So again, Rashi is explaining that what it means is if you have a rebius of stam yenim in one place, then it can become tomei like any other food or drink. Less than that, no. The Tosfos is pointing out the fact is you have many other Gemaras that imply that mashkin can become tomei in any amount. So what do you tell it? Less than a rebius. So therefore, what do we mean a rebius? The Tosfos explains what it means is. The stam yenam itself is metame other foods and drinks if there's a revius of it. In other words, according to let me clarify what we're saying. According to Rashi, what we're saying is like this: if you have less than a revius of yain nesach in a container, and let's say for example a sheretz touches it, it won't become. Hold on. According to Rashi, we're talking about whether the stam yenam itself can become tame. Only if you have a revius of it, and then let's say a sheretz touches it, will it become tame like any other food or drink. If you have less than a revius of it, and a sheretz touches it, Rashi is learning it won't become tame.
Why?
Because you have less than a revius. Tosfos is saying that doesn't work that way. Even if you have less than a revius and a sheretz touches it, it still becomes tame. What it is Tosfos says, what it means is, if other food or drinks were to touch that, they would become tame. Yeah, transfer tame. It becomes a rish in the trauma. It becomes a rish in the trauma, and it can create a shame in the trauma. Tosfos says what it means is the stam yenam itself has trauma like the trauma of other tame liquids. You have a concept that certain kinds of liquids are intrinsically tame. For example, you have the spit of a zav, the saliva of a zav. You have various other kinds of things like that. Or not actually the saliva of a zav is not really a good example. Let me rephrase that. Tosfos gives an example. Let's say, for example, a zav or a nidr or whatever. Some liquids from them, such as their saliva, are just as tame as them. They're an avatoma. Some liquids from them, for example, tears or blood from a wound or whatever, are considered, they just have tumas mashkin. They're only tame midrabanan by a tuma that applies to certain kinds of liquids. For that, you need a revius of them. So in other words, the same way as the t- tiers of a Zav, let's say, only if there was a Revius of them, would they be able to be Metame other foods and drinks.
Right.
The same way, only a Revius of Stam Yenam is enough to be Metame other foods. If you have less than that, so not like Rashi is saying that you need a Revius for it to become Tomei from a Sheret, but rather you need a Revius for it to be able to be Metame other things. That's how Tosfos learns.
So Tosfos learns that any amount, it makes it Tomei, but...
could become Tomei from something else.
Any amount could transfer tuma?
Any amount. If you have a sheretz, which is an avatoma, and it touches any amount of liquid, it will make it a rishon l'tuma.
A
sheretz or anything else that can make anything else that can make liquid tuma. Some things are raisa, some things are rabbanan.
Right.
But what we're talking about is the intrinsic tuma of stam yenim itself. That if you were to have a revius of stam yenim in one place, in a container, and then some other food were to touch it, that it should become tomei only if you have a revius, not if it was less than that.
According to
Tosfos.
Okay.
Okay. So that's category number two.
But unique to wine.
Well, it's unique to stam yenim. Well, so no, Tosfos is saying it applies to other kinds of liquids that have intrinsic tuma d'rabbanan. Again, according to Rashi, what we're saying is that according to Rashi, maybe it would be something specific to stam yenim.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. According to Tosfos, it's something more general to any liquid that has intrinsic tuma d'rabbanan. Right. Okay.
It's very different.
It is. Yeah. Okay. Category number three. Hamaskid yeno yesel over tichavim. Category number three is if somebody deposits wine for safekeeping with a goy. Also v'shtiyo motzav hana. That wine, when he gets it back, is also to drink. But it's motzav hana. It's also to drink because, as the Gemara is going to say, because the goy may have swapped it out with his own. But wait. So the question is, what do you mean it's also to drink? But we learn in a Mishnah. What do you mean it's motzav hana? V'hatznan. But we learn in a Mishnah in Zmai. Hamaskid peroisav etzel oivit kachavim. If a person deposits produce by a goy for safekeeping, then we consider them like the payers of the goy regarding meiser and regarding schmitter, because in other words we have to suspect that the goy may have swapped it out for his own stuff. So now you have to deal with the matter of meiser, and you have to deal with the matter of shvius. Not so much a matter of tumah, but a matter of as far as the dinim of meiser and as far as the dinim of schmitter. No, it's considered that we have reason to suspect that the guy may have switched it out for his own payrus. He may have eaten your payrus and replaced them with payrus of his own.
But his payrus,
okay, so according to Rashi, Rashi doesn't actually spell out in so many words. He just says that we're suspicious that they may have exchanged it, and therefore, by the same logic over here, this might be goyish wine. So the question is, why is it motzav hana? The Rambam actually understands in connection with these dinim, he says when we say Harein Kiparosev Shalom Kichavim, Moshviyah Shalom Meister, the Rambam says it means actually Bakula. Since a goy's produce is not Chayiv and Meister, and is not Chayiv and Shviyah, therefore, in other words, when you get it back, then therefore you don't have to worry about taking Meister from it. We're not talking about Tumah, but the question still is that if according to Rashi we have to be suspicious that the guy swapped it out, or according to the Rambam it's almost certain that he did, and therefore we can consider it to be the guy's payrus that you have now, then how can we say such wine would be motzav hana? If it's stam yenim, we just said stam yenim is also hana. The answer is given to Yichud Keren Zavis. The answer is, we're talking about that when he first deposited it, he designated a particular corner in his house for it, and Rashi adds that he gave the goy gave the key to that closet to the Jew, or he made a seal over there. So therefore,
in any other case,
it would be also b'hanah.
Also
so, yeah. Yeah. But over here,
comes and tells you. They were separate. They were in a special
room. Well, no. When the Jew first dropped it off, he made sure the guy showed him a particular cabinet or whatever, and he gave him the key. So the question is, Yehoki b'shtiyah nami l'shtri. In that case, shouldn't it be mutter to drink as well? Then in that case, the guy won't have swapped it out. And we know this. The Rav Yochanan is equal to Parud, because in fact, we have a case where one time Rav Yochanan visited Parud, which is it's the name of a town, but it's the town where Bar Kappara in a previous generation had lived and passed away. Omar, so he says to the people over there, Klum Yesh Mishnas Bar Kappara, do we still have over here the brightest of Bar Kappara? Is there anybody over here who still learns them?
Rhetorical?
What? Yeah, no, not necessarily rhetorical. He may have actually been asking. I want to, this is where Bar Kappara lived. Yeah, are there any Talmidim of him still around? Yeah. Tonalit of Tanchum de Min Parud, and sort of Tanchum of Parud taught him a Braisa of Baka Parud. He was one of the Talmidim, apparently, yeah. And he taught him a Braisa as follows, Hamafkid Yena Etzel Ovi Kachovim Mutzah B'Shtiyah. If you deposit wine by a goy, then it's Mutzah to drink. So in that case, what are we saying before? That it's also to drink. And the Gemara continues, Koryale, the Sertan Chum de Min Parud. I don't know, maybe he was, no, Pashat, he was an Amorah, but the Amorah, new Braisa, so, yeah. Koryale, Rabbi Yochanan referred to this situation, the pasuk in Kehelet. The pasuk says, "Makom sheyipola eitz shom yehu." Now the pasuk says, "Wherever the tree falls, there it will be." So what do you mean, shom yehu? What do you mean, there will it be? In other words, the tree is a metaphor for Talmud Chacham. So wherever he falls, wherever he passes away, there he is. So what do you mean, there he is? He passed away. He's gone. Ela shom yehu peyroisim. It means there his fruit, his produce will be. You'll find fruit. In other words, in the sense, right? In other words, like this. When Rabbi Yochanan realized that now, look at this. You want to learn something from Bar Kappara? Ask people from his hometown because they've heard from him. They learned from him. They'll teach it to others. So therefore, his fruit is still there even after he passed away. Yeah, this is as I mentioned on the WhatsApp group today. This is an example of Mazar Echaim, Apu Bechaim. When his descendants Beruchnias are still alive, then he's still alive. He's still there. Shom Yehu. There, the tree still is long afterwards. And in fact, I saw an explanation actually from the Yitzhak Lev, that's one of the early Hungarian rebbeim, that he said that's the place, the name of the place is significant. The name of the place is Parud, meaning like separated, like our people separated from the tzaddik and they have no connection with them anymore. And Reb Tanchum, Meloshen Nechama, explains to him, no, we still have a connection with the tzaddik, Bar Kappara, and let me teach you something of his. So therefore, that means, realize, look at that. Mazar b'chaim, apu b'chaim. They're not separated. They're still connected.
Maybe just in Eretz Yisrael.
Anywhere it is. Makom sheyipol eitz, wherever the tree is. The first half of that pasuk says that if a tree falls in the north or in the south or in the north, wherever it falls, there it is. Wherever the Sabbath passes away, there his effect is still, his impact is still felt over there.
But the Yochanan didn't know this mission himself, or you
know? No, he didn't know. He didn't know it. That's why he was asking.
But he knew it.
No, he was asking. Kum yesh mishnas bar kapara. So now he knew. No, he knew the pasuk, but now he saw. He was a real live application of it. Yeah.
How long
after Bar Kappara? I don't know. Doesn't say. But yeah. So Shom Yehu Peroisav. Yeah. So there was and in fact, Rabbi Yochanan himself is the one who says in Tainis, Mazar b'chaim afu b'chaim. So it fits very well with what he himself says of it. Anyway, the bottom line is that again, we had a braisa before saying that if you deposited wine by a goy, it's also to drink because the guy may have switched it out for his own wine, but it's mutter b'ana. So what's the scenario? If you didn't lock it up in a cabinet, it should be also b'ana because the guy will swap it out with his own. If you locked it up in a cabinet, then based on this mission of Bar Kappara, it should be mutter to drink. What's the case? What's the in-between case where you're allowed to drink it but not allowed to have ana from it? The answer is Omer Abzeiro, like Kasha, Harab Liyazo, Harabana. The answer is it's not a contradiction between one, because one braisa is talking to Liyazo and the other one according to the Rabbanan. Namely, the Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. Later on in our Masechta, the one that is from Rabbi Eliezer is the second one, the Mishnah Bar Kappara,
right,
that says you're allowed to drink it, and the other one will be according to the Chachamim. So wait. The Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. So again, this is going to be part of these dinim that we're going to be mostly dealing with later on in the Masechta. In the Samach, we're going to be dealing with various aspects of cases where a Jew has wine and he has where a Jew rents property and rents a building or whatever and goyish a property and stores wine over there. What are the dinim when it remains Musar and when it becomes Osir? Whether a person buys a building or whether he rents a building in the courtyard in the chotzer of a goy, and the Jew filled up that building with wine, the key or the seal is in the hands of the Jew. Rabbi Eliezer says you're allowed to drink the wine. We're not concerned that the goy will have gone in and switched it out. So there we go. The first braisa that said that's also b'hana, not b'hana, b'shia, that's also to drink, would be according to the Chachamim. The second one, the one from Bar Kappara, would be according to the Eliezer. Or another version is Amr of Chista Amr Ziri. Va'amri la Amr of Chista Amr Li Abba Bar Chama Hachi Amr Ziri. So three different versions of what the chain of transmission was on the following statement. That halacha could Rabbi Eliezer. The halacha is like Rabbi Eliezer, therefore that it is mutter to. Sometimes it happens. It's not common, but it does happen.
When?
This is an example of it.
No, I understand. Okay. The example. What's the reason why?
What the reason is? I don't know.
It's
a good question, but maybe because, like you said, since the key is in the hands of the Jew. However, wait. We're gonna get now. It's a little more complicated than that. Amar Rav Elazar, Hakol Mishtama B'Chosim Echad. Anything that you deposit in the possession of a goy, you can. It's okay if it's under one. It's okay if it's under one seal. We're not concerned that the goy is going to switch it out. Chutz min ha'yayin she'en mishtama v'choytem achad. Except for wine, where one seal is not enough. Because the goy may break the seal and then forge a new one.
In our case, when you said it's...
Well, 1 second, that's what we have to figure out. You have good quality wine, he's going to replace it with poor quality wine, whatever. Okay, so with wine, you need more than one seal. That's according to Rebbe Lazar, the Amora. No, two seals. We'll see. It's choysem b'seh choysem, it's called. A seal within a seal. Well, wait. We'll get to it soon. Rebbe Yechanan Omar. Rebbe Yechanan says, no. Apilu yayin, mishtam of a choysem echad. No, even in wine, it's enough to have one seal. V'loitzligi, and so it's not a machlik. It's hoker Rebbe Yezah, hoker Rabbanan. One is according to Rebbe Yezah, one is according to the Chacham. Or Ikadamri, another version of this discussion.
It's not exactly the same as the
Machlokes. Well, it is. Yeah, it is, because Rabbi Eliezer is saying that as long as you have the key in the hands of a Jew, then it's okay. Then you're allowed to. Whereas the Chachamim are saying it's also, presumably because they require two keys or two seals or whatever. So Rabbi Eliezer is explaining what Rabbi Eliezer is saying, and Rabbi Yechanan is explaining what the Chachamim are saying. Ikadamri, another version of that machlokes goes as follows. Amar of Elazar, Hakol Mishtama B'choysim B'seich Choysim, Chutz Min Ayayin, She'en Mishtama B'choysim B'seich Choysim. The second version is Rav Elazar is more machmir. That, he says, anything that you're depositing by a goy, you need a choysim B'seich Choysim, you need a seal within a seal. Chutz Min Ayayin, She'en Mishtama B'choysim B'seich Choysim, except for wine, even a double seal is not enough. You would actually have to have a shomer, you'd actually have to have somebody guarding it. No, not three. You have to actually have somebody guarding you, no matter how many seals you... No, in other words, no matter how many seals you have. If you don't have... Yeah. That's Rav Elazar. But Rav Yechanan, I'm after Rav Yechanan says, even wine, a choysim b'seich choysim is enough. V'tavayu k'rabbanan. Now, in that case, according to the second version, neither of them holds like Rav Elazar. Both of them are holding like the Chachamim. Namely, Marsavar, namely like this. So what's the machalikah then? Marsavar. Rabbi Yechanan holds, Ki pligi Rabbanan alei de Rabbi Eliezer b'choytem echad. When did the Rabbanan disagree with Rabbi Eliezer? Is when you have only one seal. Ava b'choytem b'seich choytem sharu. But if you have a double seal, they would say it's mutter. They would say it's mutter. Well, Marasavo, whereas Rabbi Eliezer holds, after b'choytem b'seich choytem ashi, they would say when the Chachamim say it's utter, means not just because we have one key, and in other words, one seal, but even if you have a double seal, the Chachamim would still say it's utter to drink.
You said we don't make a zero on zero.
This isn't a zero on zero. This is all part of one zero.
You make a zero, you need one seal, it's a zero.
No. When the zero, to begin with, is that wine that's in the hands of a goy, where there's a concern that he may swap it out, and a choysim b'seich choysim, you require a choysim b'seich choysim to get around that. Now, Tosfos gets into a bit of a discussion over here, because, what is the actual halacha over here? Before we're saying that the halacha is like Rav Eliezer, that you only need one seal, later on in the parak, and right over here, we said, according to Rav Yechanan, you need a seal within a seal, and the halacha is like that also. So which is it? You need one seal or two? Okay, so Tosfos starts discussing like this. Rabbi Natam says that you have two different cases. You can have a case where you're depositing it with a goy, versus you can have a case where you're depositing it with a Yisrael choshu, with a Yisrael who is suspect about that he may swap it out for treif wine. The difference is, therefore, the difference is that a Yisrael choshu is worse than a goy, because a goy, we know not to trust him too much. We know to be careful, and therefore the goy himself realizes he's under suspicion, and therefore he's going to be afraid to tamper with anything. Whereas a Yisrael Choshud, he's going to still think that everybody still thinks he's on the up and up. Therefore, he will have no problem trying to break one seal and forge it or whatever. Therefore, you need two. That's how Rabbeinu Tam.
But he can break two.
Two already it would be too hard. So okay. So why it is that two are good? Okay, hold on. So you have, because there comes. I mean, there's only so much you can do. Again, but the point is like this. Well, hold on. One reason why two. There's two different reasons why that Rishonim give why a double seal, as I'm going to describe in a minute, what a double seal consists of. Why it's okay. One way of looking at it, which is the Rambam's way, is that the second seal is something unusual. So therefore, if it's tampered with, then you'll notice that you don't have the unusual thing that was expected to be there or not.
The first one
is something that could be a usual seal. For example, we'll see soon. The Gemara will give examples over here. Let's say when you have a barrel, you have a barrel that's where the cover of it has that they usually smear clay around the edges of it to seal it up. That would be considered one seal, and then you have another seal on top of that. So the second seal would be a less usual thing. And Rashi seems to take the view that the vote is, if you have a double seal, it's too much trouble to go and forge two different seals. So therefore, he's not going to go to that much trouble. It's chashur, fine. There's a limit, even a chashur. There's only so much that he's going to. There's only so much effort that he's going to go to. So anyway, that's how Rabbeinu Tam learns. However, Tosfos goes on to say, it's hard really to accept. It's a little hard to accept that understanding of Rabbeinu Tam. Because the fact is, these various Gemaras, here or later on in the Perek, whatever, they never explicitly talk about Yisrael Chashrut versus Goy. There's a choice to use the expression. It's Nevuah. It's like Nevuah. It's like something higher. It's like something beyond Lamayim Tam Vadah to say that one set of Jinnim refers to a Goy and the other set refers to a Yisrael Chashrut.
In both cases, they want to switch the line. And the Yid is not just doing it to try to cause problems, is he?
Well, if he is, he's a Chashrut, so maybe. Okay, but this is really, this is Lloyd. He's going to take the good wine for himself and replace it with inferior wine. Yeah. Okay, so anyway, Tosfos doesn't accept that answer. Rather, Tosfos explains rather like this. We're both talking about Goyim. The difference is like this. There's a difference between, later on in the Perek, we're going to be talking about the case where you're sending wine to somebody else. Now, when Reuben takes a barrel of wine or whatever it is sending it to Shimon, Reuben is never going to see this barrel and the seals on it again. Shimon has never seen it before. Then we're saying you need a double seal to make sure that the goy doesn't swap it out or whatever. When you have, in our Gemara, we're talking about that Reuben deposited the wine with the goy, and later on he himself is going to come pick it up. Then Tosfos says that's the cases where we're saying in our Gemara over here that you only need one seal. Because you yourself are going to be fine. You're going to be picking it up afterwards, and therefore you're okay. Therefore you'll recognize it. Yeah. So those are the different ways in which Tosfos recognizes.
Which one? Tosfos says you need two.
So that's the thing. So according to the first answer of Tosfos, if you're sending it with Yisrael Choshur, you need a double one. According to the second answer, if you're sending it to somebody else, where the other person never saw your seals and you're never going to see it again, then you need a double. Then you need two. Otherwise, if you yourself are picking it up, then you only need one. Okay, so what is the definition? How do we do a choysim b'seich choysim?
He's never going to see it. What do you need for choysim?
Because how else? That's the point. And therefore, you want to make it either that it'll be something unusual enough that the other yid knows to look out for something unusual, and therefore the goy is going to have a hard time making that same unusual thing, or that it's going to be too hard for him to forge. It's going to be too much of a tircha to forge a double one like this. Right. So what is the definition of a chos and a seh chos? And how do we accomplish it? Omar Rava. So Rava says, for example, as follows.
You need two bottles?
No. Agna apuma de chavisa. So let's say, for example, you take like this. You take a barrel. You take a bowl and put it upside down on top of the barrel to close up the barrel. Shrik of a chastima. And then what you do is you smear clay around it. You smear clay where the bowl meets the edges of the barrel. That would be how the chosim b'seich chosim. That would be an example of a chosim b'seich chosim. Number one, you have a barrel. You put a bowl on top of it. Now, the normal way of stealing a barrel is not that you put a bowl on top of it. The normal way is the barrel has a lid, and then you smear clay around it.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be considered chosim b'seich chosim. To make it chosim b'seich chosim, you have to have that you took a bowl, mizrak, as I... Right. So in other words, right. So you have a barrel. You put a bowl on. You put a bowl, maybe with or without the lid. I don't know. The point is, the very fact that it's a bowl is an unusual thing.
Okay.
Mustama, I mean, you'd probably use the lid as well, because otherwise it's spilled. But the main point is that you have a bowl there. That's chosim number one. And you smear it around it. That's chosim number two. That's chosim to say chosim. That's what it is. Shrika v'chaset, agna apuma d'chaset. So if you overturn a bowl over the top of the barrel, shrika v'chasima, and you smeared clay around it, and now it's sealed, have a chosim v'seh chosim, then you have a chosim v'seh chosim.
Where's the chosim v'seh chosim?
Because you have the what do you call it, the bowl is the one chosim, and the smearing around it is the second one. Because you put it tightly over the barrel. Another example is if you took a basket and overturned it on top of the barrel. So with the bowl, I guess we're not talking about that there's a cover, because with the basket over here, Rashi mentioned that you have the magufa already, you have the lid of the barrel. So with the bowl, we're talking about there's no lid. The bowl itself serves as a lid. So that's chosim number one, because
right.
Usually you would have a lid, and the smearing clay around it to seal it shut, that would be chosim number two. So another example, dikulo mehadik, another example is if you take a basket and put it over the top of the barrel, so here you have the barrel is already closed with its lid. So now you have a
basket.
Right. So the basket, you have a basket tightly on top of it. Where Rashi says like it fits in very, very tightly. So then that itself is chosim b'seh, have a chosim b'seh chosim. Then it's considered a chosim b'seh chosim, because again, to be able to get it on so exactly that it'll
smear it.
No, you don't even have to smear it, in other words, is the point. But it's mehadik, it's tightly on. Rashi, nichnet b'dochet, piyasal, l'vloyat ha'chobis. The barrel just exactly fits into the mouth of the basket. Then you have a chosim b'seh chosim, because then it's going to be too much of a tircha for him to find another basket, just break open that one, and then afterwards find another basket that'll be exactly that size. That'll, yeah. So then that's good. Lo mahadik, why have a chosim b'seh chosim? Again, if it's not so tight, then it's too easy to take off. Then it's not considered as if it exists at all.
There
has to be very, very tight, right? Exactly fit. Yeah. Another example. Noid b'diskia. If you have a wine skin, again we mentioned
back to the Gemara,
yeah. Noid b'diskia. So again, a noid is a wine skin. As we said in the Mishnah, sometimes they would make bags out of skin and store wine in them. So if you put a noid, you put a wine skin that's full of wine and tied shut, and you put it b'diskia. You put it inside a sack which goes on the back of a donkey or whatever. Diski actually is a double sack. D-sackia, really it is. It means a double sack, because they have this way the load is distributed evenly on the two sides of the donkey. So you put the noid inside the diskia. So then how do you make a chosim b'seh chosim? Chasimas piv l'mata. If you have the ceiling, the closing of the noid is on the bottom of the diskia. In other words, so you took the noid, you flipped it over, and put it mouth side down into the diskia. You would do that because it's tied tightly shut, so the wine's not going to leak out of it. And so then what you do is, having tied it tightly shut, you turn it over and you put it with the tied side down inside the diskia. That's also have a chosim b'seh chosim. That also works as a chosim b'seh chosim, because, as Rashi says, it's too. So again, according to Rashi, that's a matter of tircha. It's too much of a bother, therefore, for anybody who would try to swap things out. He'd have to undo the diskia. Then he'd have to take out the noid and untie it and retie it. That much, it's too much of a tircha. According to Rambam, that's a matter of unusual things. You don't usually put a noid in upside down. But if the mouth of the noid is on the top, is near the opening of the diskia, then it's not a chosim b'seh chosim, because then it's not so much trouble to open it up and swap it out. What about another possibility? The kikayif pumei legav. Another possibility. Let's say we take the noid itself and we take the edges of it and fold them inward, v'tzayir v'chosim, and then we shut it and then we tie it closed and seal it shut, which is Rashi describes. In his time, they would do like that. They do like that with bags that hold oil. So in other words, what they would do, Rashi describes, is they first tie it in the usual way. Then they take the edges after it's tied and fold them inward and then tie it again. So then, even without a disc, you have a choysim b'seh choysim, and that's also a choysim b'seh choysim. Because again, it would be too much trouble to undo and redo all of that in a way that it wouldn't be detectable, and therefore he's not going to bother.